This is Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Edward Baptist now joins us. Edward Baptist, Associate Professor of History and Dean of Carl Becker House at Cornell University. He's the author of the new book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. He has also just published a reader called American Capitalism, a reader. It was co-written with Lewis Hyman. We are going to be in conversation about slavery and the development of American capitalism. Edward Baptist, it's my great pleasure to welcome you to our program.
Thanks, Mitch. It's great to be here.
And am I accurate there to say slavery and American capitalism, or should we say slavery and capitalism, or the development of capitalism in general?
Well, I think you could say both. And in the book, I focus on American capitalism, but global capitalism is also part of the story. Britain and other world markets are crucial to the way that American slavery develops.
Does slavery play a key component to the early days of capitalism, or is this more of a story, which I think your book really focuses on, of the 19th century?
Well, there's a lot of disagreement, of course, about what capitalism is and when it starts, but I like to think that when we talk about capitalism as we understand it today, we're really talking about a process that begins around 1800 as human societies, first in places like Britain and the United States, make the transition from being primarily agricultural to being much more focused on industry. And in those kinds of societies, growth is much faster. People's living conditions in some cases get better, in some cases get worse. But there's a new kind of dynamism to economic growth and economic and technological progress in those societies.
What's central here is cotton. Can we say cotton was to the 19th century what oil is to our economy today?
Absolutely. It's the most important commodity. It's the most widely traded commodity on world markets up until sometime late in the 19th century. But it's absolutely crucial to both the development of capitalism in general and specifically to the development of American capitalism.
So tell me about industries that are connected to cotton in the 19th century.
Well, up until about the 1840s, if we're talking about industry, and by industry we mean factories with machines that are making things much more quickly than traditional kinds of production could have made them, we're talking almost exclusively about cotton. We're talking about cotton being spun and then woven into textiles, into cloth, which is in some cases then assembled into clothing, in other cases just shipped as is, and it's sent around the world. And every year in the early 19th century, the market for this cloth gets bigger. More traditional kinds of making cloth are getting displaced in more and more societies. It's only after about the 1840s that other industries start to become prominent. And in many cases, we find there's a direct connection to the cotton factories. So, for instance, when we start to see railroads and the building of locomotives and the manufacture of iron rails and things like that, when that starts to become an important industry in the U.S. and Britain, often there's a direct connection to the cotton factories. People who learn how to make and fix cotton machines learn how to make and fix locomotives.
So one led to the other.
Yeah, what economists call knock-on effects. All of our industry that we see today, all of the things, all of the ways that products are made, and all of the products that are made far away and shipped to us and used by us are to some extent a knock-on effect of this tremendous boom in cotton textile production, but also cotton production.
I just sort of want to stay here for a moment on cotton itself. Obviously, we take it for granted today, the significance of cotton in the 19th century, what it meant, and we're not quite yet there talking about the people who made it, what it meant for their lives, but for what it meant for others who consumed it.
It's really interesting as you follow cotton, and there's a great book that's going to be coming out later this year by a Harvard historian named Sven Becker, and he really looks at the global history of cotton itself, going far beyond the United States. But what's interesting about cotton is that it can be made and cloth can be made from it in such quantity that it really transforms the way that Westerners and eventually most human beings think about clothes. Up until the early 1800s, most people in the United States or in Britain or wherever else had very few clothes in their, I would say, closet, but they didn't even really have closets in their possession. They might only have a couple of outfits. And once it's possible to make cotton cloth and clothes so much more cheaply, then the problem becomes not just convincing someone to buy an outfit or to buy some cloth that they need to make into their winter clothing. The problem becomes, how do you convince people to buy things that they don't actually think they need? How do you convince them to wear a different set of clothes every single day, which is a relatively recent development in human history?
Ed Baptist, tell me about what is known as the whipping machine and how it plays into this story.
So the whipping machine is, I think, a metaphor, and it comes from the testimony of a formerly enslaved person named Henry Clay. He's born into slavery in North Carolina, and then he's moved to Louisiana, and he goes to work on a cotton plantation, or slave labor camp, as I sometimes call them. Well, in the fields, he discovers that the work is very, very difficult. And according to him, his enslaver had a system for making people work harder and faster. If someone didn't work up to the standards that the enslaver demanded, the enslaver would take them to a machine he had built. And it consisted of a bench, and there was a sort of wheel that was suspended over the bench. And on the wheel were attached a whole bunch of short whips, basically. So you would strap the individual who hadn't worked fast enough down onto the bench, and then you would crank the wheel. And the wheel would systematically whip the person's back into jelly, basically. Now, this may have been something that actually existed, but it's also, I think, a metaphor for the larger system that was installed in the lives of enslaved people on the cotton frontier of the South. You see, enslaved people are moved from older states starting in the late 1700s, older states like Maryland and Virginia, to newer states like Georgia and South Carolina, Alabama, where cotton is grown. And they're made to work much more intensely in those newer states. And the whipping machine is a good metaphor for talking about the really systematic way in which they were forced to labor harder.
What we see throughout the 19th century is an increase in the production of cotton. Is it attributed that you eventually had more people who were working as slaves, that you had more land, or is it also this issue of forcing people to pick more and more and more as much as possible?
It's really all of those things at once. So a million people are moved south and west from the older states, many of them literally in chains and a domestic slave trade, which becomes quite large and quite an important part of the American economy. And then there's also a huge amount of land, most of it acquired ultimately from Native Americans, sometimes directly through war and treaties and forced sales and the Trail of Tears itself, in which Native Americans are moved to what is today Oklahoma as part of this story. But even though much more land is added to the total amount of land that's growing cotton and the number of people who are growing cotton is increased dramatically, what you also find is that we can demonstrate that the amount of cotton each enslaved person is growing and picking increases dramatically. So in other words, the productivity of cotton labor increases over time. And our best estimates suggest that in picking, which is sort of the bottleneck of production, the slowest part of it, and thus it's the thing that kind of governs the speed of the whole system, that increases 400% over the period between 1800 and 1860. So enslaved people like Henry Clay by 1860 are picking four times as much cotton in the day as they did in 1800, or as their predecessors did in 1800.
The increase in productivity of cotton is directly linked to the expansion of slavery?
Yeah, it is in lots of ways, and not just because of the addition of new land and the forced migration, the importation of new laborers. I think it's also possible when you take a million people and you put them through that kind of process of disruption, and we know from the accounts they left behind that sometimes it was terrifically psychologically and personally disruptive and it took a long time to recover. When you put them through that, then you can impose new things on them, new systems, new ways of doing. You can force them to work faster and longer hours and all those sorts of things, which were a little more difficult to do on older plantations where people knew each other better. They could figure out ways to sort of collectively resist a bit more effectively and so on.
Ed Baptist, in your book, The Half Has Never Been Told, you write that the expansion of slavery made the South wealthier for white people than any other part of the world. In 1860, of the seven wealthiest states per capita for whites in the country, six were southern cotton states: Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida. You say, in fact, the 6 million white southerners were probably the richest group of human beings in the world in 1860. Tell me more about that.
And this is just an incredible thing, because our story has usually been that the South was poor, and it certainly was poorer than the North if you look only at the older states, and if you look at a total population that includes enslaved African Americans. And of course, enslaved African Americans were part of the population, but their economic well-being was not really part of the calculation, the calculations that are being made by white Southerners, and they're not seen as by those white Southerners as part of the same community. So I think it's pretty remarkable to see how much wealth was accumulated there during that period. But at the same time, I think what we have to recognize is that that wealth was actually going everywhere. So the wealth that's generated by the productivity increase of enslaved people working under the threat of the whip in the field is not just being accumulated in the South. And in fact, lots of people have acknowledged this before, but I think one of the things that I try to do in the book is to show exactly how extensive and how consequential that wealth accumulation is. I think it's absolutely crucial to the development of the American economy as a whole.
Again, we are in conversation with Edward Baptist, Associate Professor of History and Dean of Carl Becker House at Cornell University. We're in conversation about his new book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Along with his fellow teacher at Cornell University, Lewis Hyman, he has also just written The American Capitalism, a reader that you can also get in electronic form. Edward Baptist, in a moment, I'd like to jump into the financialization around slavery. But before we do that, a little more on the issue of cotton and productivity and torture. Do you see traces of how business is run today to this time?
That's a good question, and you know, maybe some parts of this are speculative and maybe some parts aren't. So let me try to identify the difference. So what's not speculative is this, which is that the reason that productivity increased in the cotton fields is because of a system of very carefully calibrated torture, as I put it in the book. And it worked essentially like this. If you were an enslaved person who was moved to, let's say, Alabama and put into a cotton field, you would be sent out to pick on your first day, and picking was actually a very difficult process. It's not doesn't involve a lot of strength, but it involves constant repetitive motion, constant picking of the cotton off of the plant. And from your first day's picking, enslavers would have a good sense of what your sort of basic capacity was, and let's say it was 50 pounds. And then they would tell you, most of the other people are picking, let's say, 60 or 70 pounds. We expect you to get to 60 pounds pretty quickly. And if you didn't get there, you'd get whipped. And every day, by the way, you'd be your take, the amount you picked, would be weighed, and this would be recorded. In fact, the sort of spreadsheets or ledgers which record how much cotton everybody was picking every day is probably the single most common document that we can find in the records of southern plantations. So if you didn't bring your quota up to a sort of basic level, you'd be picked. But once you did bring your quota up, then you'd be pushed a little faster. You'd be told, okay, now you need to learn how to pick 65 pounds. And again, if you didn't do that, you'd be whipped. And these whippings were quite brutal. And I think if we weren't so used to thinking about plantations as a sort of gone with the wind places, we would have been calling this torture for a very long time. It certainly fits most definitions of torture. So
To call it torture.
Yeah. I think we need to call it what it was. We need to recognize that this is, along with the measurement and the fact that enslaved people knew that this was coming, and so they had to work at a sort of continuous high pace, and they had to think very carefully about how to be efficient with their motion and so on and so forth, that this torture, which is driving the whole system, is crucial to the world we live in today. In fact, we live in a world that is partly shaped by that, because cotton was so essential to the development of capitalism.
Do you think we can even find a firmer connection between the financialization of slavery in the 19th century and our financial world today?
There are many aspects of the financialization of slavery which are strikingly reminiscent of our current financial world and our recent financial troubles, let's say, in 2008, and the things that led up to that. I mean, one of the things maybe you're alluding to is the fact that enslavers needed lots of money. They needed credit because they were continually trying to expand the number of slaves that they put into the field, and enslaved people were very expensive. So they borrowed money to buy more slaves from the domestic slave trade. And it so happened that there were always people willing to lend them money. And increasingly, they got more and more creative about ways to lend money and to make money off the financialization of the expansion of cotton. One of the things they did was to create bonds which were very similar in their way to the mortgage bonds, which were so essential to the expansion of the world financial system over the last 20 to 30 years, but were also heavily implicated in the 2008 financial crisis. And these bonds were essentially bonds that documents that entitled the holder to a stream of repayments on the mortgages that enslavers took out as they bought new slaves. So almost identical in that sense to mortgage bonds. And they were sold on world financial markets. They made about 6% generally, something like that, which was a very good return, especially if it was a nice, steady, reliable return. And people, when they bought them, thought, well, there's always a market for slaves, and so we'll be able to get paid back on these bonds. It didn't quite turn out that way in some cases, just as it didn't in 2008.
So there were slave mortgages?
Yeah. Slaves were mortgaged, and in fact, one scholar named Bonnie Martin estimates that the amount of mortgages on slaves in Louisiana in 1860 was greater than the total book value of enslaved human beings in Louisiana in that year, which suggests that, in fact, some individuals were mortgaged twice or maybe even three times.
Similar, and just trying to relate it to modern financial terms and transactions, did they create bundles then? I mean, were these used as ways to then even make more money the way we see it today with speculation?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the bonds that I was just talking about, which were particularly prevalent in the 1830s, are certainly bundled. We can't say they're necessarily bundled slaves or bundled human beings in that sense, but they are bundles of streams of income from those people, I think is probably a better way to think about it technically.
Were these, you know, we call quote-unquote financial instruments developed during this period?
The mortgage bonds are probably new. We can find one or two little antecedents in one in Germany, for instance, but it's not clear that enslavers and bankers even knew about that precedent. It seems to be something that they just thought up very, very innovatively in that sense at the time. But what's interesting about it is that it entitles people all around the world to make money from enslaved people's labor pretty directly. And in fact, to buy a mortgage bond, which were usually priced about the same as an individual slave, was actually in some ways more profitable to some people than owning an individual slave, because a mortgage bond is not going to die of malaria because it's been moved to a horrifically deadly disease environment. It's not going to run away. It's not going to fight back against an overseer and get shot down in a field. But, of course, a man or a woman all of those things could happen, and all of those things could happen to them, and they could die or otherwise not actually produce the profit that the enslaver expected. So people who invested in slavery in some ways were investing in sort of almost a more commodified form of exploitation via slavery.
Is this connected at all to buying insurance for slaves?
It's related. Insurance becomes more and more prevalent in the 1840s and 1850s, and it's pretty clear that most of the major insurance firms that develop, and they primarily develop in Connecticut and a few other northern states, but they develop investing quite a lot in the insuring of enslaved people.
And I guess the now defunct Lehman Brothers participated in this activity, or are there other companies that we recognize today or that have at least connections to what was happening with the financialization of slavery?
Yeah, well, banks, like other corporations, we've heard are now people, but they actually live a lot longer than people and can change form. So there are a lot of banks today which are what you might call successor banks to banks that invested very heavily in slavery one way or another. Wachovia, which became, I think, Bank of America, some of these connections were recently revealed. Wachovia Bank, the predecessor to Wachovia Bank, invested very heavily in the domestic slave trade in North Carolina. Likewise, Lehman Brothers, which you mentioned, actually begins as a cotton trading firm in Mobile in the wake of two financial crises in a row, 1837 and 39, which are really caused by the astonishing success of investment in the cotton frontier. And there's a sort of 2008-style explosion of the world financial economy as a result of the bubble that emerges. Well, that kills off a lot of the existing cotton firms, and Lehman Brothers moves in as a kind of pop-up firm that has a little bit of cash and no debts at that point, unlike all of its competitors. And they start buying up cotton left and right, and eventually they become the Lehman Brothers that we know.
Ed Baptist, you referenced the Economist magazine review of your book, in which they got in a little bit of trouble, mostly for this line: almost all the blacks in his book are victims, almost all the whites, villains. This is not a history, it's advocacy. The Economist eventually apologized for that. What was your take on their apology?
It was, first of all, the whole process was sort of amusing to watch, because it came out, the review came out on a Thursday, and by the time Friday rolled around, there were, I think, 5 pages of universally negative comments on their website, and they were in the process of apologizing for it. So I thought that was one of those moments where social media, did something that was positive in some sense. But I am kind of ambivalent about them apologizing for it. I think if that's what The Economist stands for, then they should stand for that. Saying they don't stand for it.
I mean, the case they were making, perhaps they still stand by. I mean, it's not specific in their apology, but it does say about your book, getting more to the meatier aspects of it, it states, The Economist says about your book, that you overstate the case when you dismiss the traditional explanations of America's success, its individualistic culture, Puritanism, the lure of open land and high wages, Yankee ingenuity, and government policy. The Economist accuses you of overlooking all those things and only looking at slavery.
Yeah, the funny thing is, I think with the exception of Puritanism, which I do dismiss, I think I say that enslavers can be, and their success, and with that, the larger success of the American economy can be accounted for in part by all of those characteristics. I mean, government policy seized hundreds of thousands of square acres and distributed it to slave owners. Government policy helped ensure a steady flow of credit to them. Ingenuity, I mean, the system for extracting continual gains in productivity from unwilling enslaved workers, it's it's diabolical, but it's ingenious at the same time, right? So I think though that critique of my book is not to me persuasive.
Edward Baptist has been our guest, again, the Associate Professor of History and Dean of Carl Becker House at Cornell University. We've been in conversation about his new book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Edward Baptist, I thank you greatly for taking time and joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been an honor.